has caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
No, I think you are face prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate fart. Daisy is just the ultimate fart.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You caused confusion and delay.
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. Bit grey today.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the second stream for tonight, for various reasons. Deep Store is going to be tonight. Oh no, Kristen's blunder has got wet. Shit. Oh, I hope that dries out. Okay. That's an antique, that book. Bloody hell. My glass was wet. Okay. All right. So, welcome to this stream where I'm going to be going through the 8 books that I have published to date, how they came about, who I published them with, and you know what they're about as a bit of a guide, and where you can get them if indeed you're interested. I'm sure most of you will not be interested in lots of these books, but I thought this might be interesting. I had the idea of doing this stream ages ago, just never got round to it. But I thought, well, you know, why not do it now? And then hopefully next week and the week after, I should have Pharaoh on to do our Christmas ad specials, which are a bit of an institution at this point. Okay. Somebody saying, where do I find dystopian fiction? I believe I put that on Substack. You can get it in the complete works of Max Barhouse, which is not included in this little overview that we're doing today. But I did put it out as a Substack piece a while back. Yeah, so there we go. It's on Substack right now. So I'll put that in the... I'll put that in the chat there, and you can read it there. All right. So just before we get going here, also, I will do my best to take any questions. Obviously, super chats are prioritized, but I will try to keep an eye on the normal chat, and I'll, you know, just see if, as I did there, I can kind of catch questions live, as it were. Let me bring up the front cover so I can remember what books there are. Here we go. I'll just share that. Can you all see that? You can all see that. And I should remind people, if you buy my courses, currently the Christmas sale is on, ladies and gentlemen. Vax Y2.
Place your foot on the base and pull the handle backward. Press the on-off button to switch the machine on.
And unlike many countries in the West, including...
I won't play it all because I'll get copyright. It is copyrighted, that song. Although I did double check before using it. Apparently he doesn't get the royalties for it. They go to his... he sold rights apparently to that song in 1997, so they go to some, you know, faceless corporation instead. So there we go. Apparently that song was used in the Joker movie, and it was a bit of controversy over, like, well, you know, does this mean he gets royalties? No. B has just sent a kind of, you know, member chat saying this is a propaganda post encouraging the elite geniuses in AA's chat to go and see Godzilla Minus One this week. All right. So let me start then with my first book called Shakespeare's History Plays, Rethinking Historicism. And it came out back 2012. Now, this book was actually based on my PhD thesis, which I started writing in 2006, believe it or not. And the story about how I came to write that thesis is, you know, I'm going to go into like the lore behind each of these books and what they're about. Okay. And so I did my PhD thesis. I did my undergraduate degree in a place called Royal Holloway University. It's the University of London. It's one of the colleges of the University of London. I can't remember what all the different colleges are in London. Basically, you all get the same degree, you get a University of London degree, okay? And I remember at that time going around, I had offers from all sorts of different universities, like, I can't remember all the different ones now. You know, Durham was one of them, and I can't remember the ones I put down. But basically, Royal Holloway had a nice building. And I thought, well, this looks like a cool place. And the important thing that it had, I wanted a closed campus. I wanted a kind of a campus type place. So I went to Royal Holloway. Among other things, I had a McDonald's scholarship to go there. I've told this story before, that pick up that McDonald's scholarship. I went to the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff, and was presented that along with some of the other winners of the McDonald's scholarship. And I had a badge, and I had my name on it, and it said winner on the badge, winner, right? And I remember that I was very proud of that badge that said winner on it, because how often do you get a badge of your name where it says literally winner under your name? So I remember I took that to university and I put it on my, it was on like my desk. So yeah, winner. But they gave me quite a bit of money for that. I seem to remember I wrote an essay on the work-life balance, and I made some suggestions for how they could improve work practices at McDonald's. And one of the things I suggested was a mentorship scheme where old members of staff would kind of take a younger member of staff under their wing. And I want to say they actually introduced that. I want to say some version of that was rolled out based on what I outlined in my scholarship or whatever it was. I'm kind of, some people make fun of that, but I was always kind of proud of that. I still put on my CV now. If I apply for a job, I always put the McDonald's scholarship in my CV because, do you have one? Not many people have one, you know. anyway, I went to Royal Holloway, and then, I did well there, as I've explained before. I was a top student there, and I remember they wrote to my reference, one of my references once, that I got the top grade there in 80 years, something like that. You know, in English, so I did pretty well. I had a very high average grade, I was good at English. I've always been very good in English. That's why I did English. Could have done other subjects. I had been probably more interested in philosophy and history. And in fact, the other university offers I had were not for English. They were for kind of, there was a joint honours one, English and philosophy at, I think it was York. Is there a university in York? I can't remember now. But I had a greater interest in philosophy than I did in English. And I was also more into history as well. But I was very good at English. sometimes you don't argue. Sometimes you just have to kind of follow what you're best at. And I was best at English. And back then I wanted to be I had gone into university, believe it or not, wanting to be a film critic or a TV critic, something like that. I wanted to write on. My hero was Clive James. I had this book called Clive James on Television, which was a book of old TV reviews that Clive James had done in the 70s and the 80s. And I also loved film with Barry Norman. And when I was a teenager, I wrote to Barry Norman and I said, listen, I want to be a film critic like you, Barry Norman. And he wrote back to me and he said, well, basically what you want to do is get yourself a good English degree, go to Oxbridge or to London and get yourself a good English degree. That's the first port of call. And that's what I did. I was also into that age. I was kind of still in school. I was into like poetry. So I kind of like fancied myself as a bit of a writer as well, as I think a lot of young English students do. And so I had kind of some vague notion of also doing writing on the side, which is why I did English. And, I remember I very pretentiously as when I was still in school, I was buying, but, you know, Yeats and Keats and, I'd be like sitting under a tree reading Wordsworth and stuff like that. Much like how I imagine young Columba, you know, Columba now, he's a bit like that. He's a kind of, you know, I see aspects of my own younger self in the way Columba is these days. I was also into, Bowie, as I said before, and Dylan and people like that. I did as Barry Norman said, and turned out I was pretty good at English. And really, it kind of just made sense to carry on. So like when you get the sort of grades I was getting, rather than like start a career, I thought, well, you know, the next, you know, I might as well just do a master's and a PhD at this point, because I was kind of, I was having professors and things tell me like, you know, you could, when I was an undergraduate, they were saying, well, you could teach this class. I was doing well, I'll put it that way. Given my grades and so on, I went to Oxford. And when I got there, I was greatly disappointed with the English department. And one of the problems was that I didn't do my master's degree in Shakespeare. I did it in modern literature. I was into T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound and also Samuel Beckett. I did my master's dissertation on Samuel Beckett and playwrights like Pinto and people like that. And one of the issues I had with the master's degree I did is that it was extremely historicist, basically. It was just all history. And I was like, well, I didn't come to do history. This is just like archival research. There's no like appreciation of the actual literature here. This is just about like, I'll never forget. I'm trying to remember I won't name the professor, obviously, but I remember sitting, we were doing like Virginia Woolf, and the professor was really excited and he was like, oh, you know, I've made a breakthrough. I think this post box here is the actual post box that's mentioned in this book by Virginia Woolf. And I remember sitting there and thinking like, what the fuck is this? And then I was meeting like the other Steve, like what were the other people doing their projects on? What were they interested in? And it was like, hey, I want to write on birds in James Joyce. And then kind of look at what their actual project was, and it was basically a kind of dissertation about species of birds, like types of birds, with a tenuous link to James Joyce. I was thinking, how is Oxford? Like this is it? This is doing English? Like, what is this? So I started developing around that time a kind of anti-historicist thesis in my mind that I wanted to try to rescue the discipline from what I saw as like overemphasis on historicism. At the same time, there was an awful lot of Marxist theory being taught, and I had kind of deep-rooted struggles with the Marxist theory that was being pushed in the discipline. There was a lot of materialist analysis, and the way it was done in Oxford, it was often divorced from the actual theory. But having done theory in my previous degree, because there was a core theory course that we were all made to do, and I kind of had a natural propensity to be interested in theory, capital T theory. I kind of saw that ultimately this was a Marxist attack on the idea of individual genius and the idea of the individual in literature. So at that point, I wanted to try to, like, how can we divest ourselves of this heavily Marxist frame that sees individuals as a function of their time and place only, right? Because you can see why the Marxists ultimately don't like the great man in history, right? And the classical liberals don't like the great man in history. We know this. And I basically wanted to try to rescue the great man and rescue the great writer, specifically the great writer in history, because in their frame, great writers, like a writer like Shakespeare, for example, is no longer a great genius, or is no longer a visionary, is no longer a kind of exceptional talent, kind of speaking universal truths about human nature. Instead, they are entirely a function of their time and place, and a kind of a retinue of, like, a kind of vessel for power to speak its prejudices, right? So in their hands, Shakespeare becomes merely a sexist, merely a royalist, merely a kind of a sniveling toady of the court, a racist, and all this sort of stuff. If you've done any kind of English at any sort of level, you'll have experienced, these bog standard feminist or post-colonial critiques. But the actual basis for all of them is a type of materialist Marxism, which underpins it all. Okay. I pinpointed Louis Althusser as one of the root kind of theoretical sources of this sort of thinking. Another one, of course, is Michel Foucault, who was less materialist and less Marxist. He was more post-structuralist. But basically, I thought these two figures, Althusser and Foucault, were chiefly responsible. I mean, there's also the Frankfurt School, who are a little bit one side of this, and what is known as the cultural turn in Marxism. That is Antonio Gramsci. Now, all of you people who are aware of the of what people have since called, you know, I mean, I don't like the term cultural Marxism, some people have called it. And I mean, I understand why it was called that. It's a cultural turn in Marxism, right? But everybody who's trying to like get a sense of the long march through the institutions is aware of the role of this form of Marxism and what was called in the 1960s and the 1970s the new left, a kind of Maoist turn in the European and indeed the American left from the 60s, from about the mid-60s onward, I would say. And new historicism and also a movement called cultural materialism tended to be British. New historicism tended to be American, was the kind of the manifestation through which a lot of this sort of stuff ended up taking over the English department, okay? However, it also happened in the history department. It also happened in the in the anthropology department. It also happened. So all of these things are connected in a way because it's the same kind of nexus of ideas that took over department to department, right? And English literature is, I think, an important department within the university because it kind of, how can I put it? It's what I call a magpie discipline, right? A magpie discipline. What does that mean? It means it's one of the few disciplines that takes from all the other disciplines, right? There's a little bit of anthropology, a little bit of sociology, there's a little bit of economics, there's a little bit of history, there's a little bit of psychology. It all kind of gets absorbed into English. And sometimes what happens is that they actually fail to take over these ideas. They fail to take over the actual department. So like if we take the example of new historicism, okay, it attempted to take over the history department and it was rebuffed. It was rebuffed by old historians like G.R. Elton, who was David Starkey's mentor, right? That if you know David Starkey was around today, his mentor was a guy called G.R. Elton. People like him and people like Starkey himself were like, no, you're not taking over this turf. you out. Back to your tenements. And you can see this kind of fierce policing of certain departments, right? So what happened is that all of the kind of deconstructionist ideas that were rebuffed from actual big H history department, they ended up sneaking over and taking over the English department instead. And then from the base of the English department, they then, over time, sneakily end up taking back over the history department because now they've got a base. Now the virus has a home and it can start spreading out. Another example, right, in psychology, Freudian ideas, Freud was generally, at least by the 60s and the 70s, you know, he had been discredited. I'm not saying that there were no Freudians, but generally the psychology department had become a lot more empirical in its way of operating and thinking. And if anybody has ever been to an actual psychology department, you know, yeah, you'll probably have to read Freud, but it will come kind of with a set of critiques already. And, you know, they'll point out that, you know, some of his findings may have been dubious or whatever. Not the case in English. Freudian psychoanalysis for a period of in the 1970s was able to start taking English. And again, when there is a bulwark of scholars in the English department putting out psychoanalysis type stuff, it can then start to spread out again. Okay, so you can understand that the English department, I think, is not to be underrated as, like, there can be a kind of snootiness on behalf of some people. We think, oh, well, it's just English, it doesn't matter. Actually, it matters. It's probably one of the departments that matters most. Because if you don't properly police that, if it takes over that, then it's a kind of backdoor. It's like a second chance for a lot of these bad theories that get rebuffed in their own disciplines to land somewhere else, okay? I wanted to write a thesis against historicism, okay? And initially I wanted to do this at Oxford itself, right? And I did. I actually got I had a supervisor and I had an offer from Oxford. And I thought, do you know what? I'm not sure if this person has the intellectual chops to understand what I want to do here. So I ended up writing. I ended up writing to one of my old professors, and saying, like, listen, here's what I want to do. You've written a bit on this before. What do you reckon? I might just come back. He was like, okay, we'll probably be able to get you a scholarship. Come back. And so I did. I went back to Royal Holloway because I had the right supervisor for the project, right? And really, when you're doing a PhD, the supervisor is the most important person. Turned out to be a very good decision because, as I've mentioned before, this supervisor of mine basically taught me how to write again. He basically stripped down all of the elements of me as a researcher and writer and built them back up again. Because I had been used to kind of coasting along on like flair and original analysis. And he was like, PhD level, you have to knuckle down basically. And a lot of the stuff that I've in foundations of writing, for example, and foundations of research, all of these courses were basically things that I was taken through the ringer by this very exacting supervisor that I had. Oh, it just so happens that he was like a hardcore Marxist, but that's kind of by the by. He had extremely high standards. And if I had had any other supervisor, I probably wouldn't have had that. A lot of people who read my books say, they're always well written. I can always understand what you're saying. And that really comes down to how, what a hardcore supervisor I had. Okay. I wanted to write this thesis against historicism. I wanted to kind of take it on as a kind of discipline-wide problem, right? But obviously you can't write a PhD thesis on kind of just that. Needs to sit somewhere. And it just so happens that Shakespeare was the home of new historicism and cultural materialism. Shakespeare was the place that they most firmly had taken over within the discipline. And also within English, Shakespeare tends to be the testing ground for all approaches. If you have an approach, if you have a new school, and you can't do it on Shakespeare plays, basically the kind of the movement lives or dies, basically. It's a kind of theoretical battleground. So everything happens in Shakespeare first, and it starts seeping out from there to all of the other parts of the discipline, if that makes any sense. There aren't many exceptions to that rule that I can think of. The only one that never took root, the only discipline, the only kind of school within English that never took over Shakespeare properly was deconstruction. Deconstruction was a Yale thing, and they took over the romantic. They were kind of romanticists, a lot of them. But they never managed to take over the Shakespeare bit, and therefore deconstruction died pretty quickly within English as an actual like top line movement. There was a guy called Paul de Man, who some people may have read, but basically it went nowhere because they couldn't take over the Shakespeare bit. They were kind of fended off or contained by people doing other sort of work, basically. Basically decided, he was like, well, I strongly recommend doing the thesis on Shakespeare, because one, you'll get a job at the end of it, two, it'll people will actually read the book, which they did, and three, it is basically central to the topic anyway, right? So my thesis, my original PhD thesis, basically had two halves. The first half was my basically attack on new historicism and cultural materialism. It's called Rethinking Historicism. It was originally called Against Historicism, right? Against. My supervisor got me to tone that down a bit because, you know, it was too adversarial, right? And you have to kind of wear kid gloves a little bit, especially when you're a PhD student as opposed to like a established professor or something. So it was called Rethinking Historicism, and the first half of it is basically a critique on new historicism and cultural materialism, and it's also a story of what happened to the English departments. Everybody talks about, well, the long march through the institutions, the Marxist takeover, you know, why is every Shakespeare production now all like black people and stuff like that. But if you want to understand how that came about, if you want to know how it happened, the first half of my first book, Shakespeare's History Plays, tells the story. It explains how we got here, right? Because it starts off as historicism, but then this becomes a Trojan horse, basically, for politics. That's basically what it is. It's a Trojan horse for politics and activism within the subject. Because now it's not a reading. It's not like you're no longer reading King Lear and saying, well, what's this play about? You know, what was Shakespeare trying to do? Look at the language, look at the characters. You're no longer engaged in that sort of work. You're now looking at the social, cultural, and political milieu that produced the play, such as King Lear, with its stereotypical attitudes towards women, with its monarchical assumptions about the world. And essentially what, you know, typically speaking, the new historicists would say, Shakespeare is on the side of power. Shakespeare is an apologist for power. Shakespeare is a vessel for power. When Shakespeare writes, it's really James the First speaking, or it's really the court of Elizabeth the First speaking. When Shakespeare speaks, you are getting the state ideology of Tudor England. That was their kind of big thing, really. I'm kind of simplifying it down a little bit. The cultural materialists, on the other hand, they tended to read plays against the grain. So they would be like, well, maybe the new historicists were right, that Shakespeare was a royalist and a sexist and a racist and all the rest of it. But that doesn't mean there are not dissident voices in the text. That doesn't mean that we can't read these plays subversively against the grain. And that really we can expose the quote-unquote contradictions in the plays. And even if Shakespeare was an awful racist, we can read them in such a way that has revolutionary potential. We can take a Shakespeare play and destabilize gender and destabilize race and nationality and identity and all the rest of it. We can pick up a Shakespeare play and read it through the lens of a queer dissident subculture. Hope this sounds familiar to you, and I hope you can see how this stuff is relevant and why I was interested in it back then. Okay. So what I was trying to do is to say, like, listen, we don't need to do any of these things. We can actually read Shakespeare in a very different way. Right. How you do that, you'd have to read the book. But so the first half of Shakespeare's History Plays, the first book by me, basically shares a whole bulk of my PhD thesis. And then the second half is my reading of the history plays. And it's me demonstrating a different way of reading the history play, free of new historicism and cultural materialism, using some of their tools, but ultimately reading it in a different way. My reading of the history plays basically shows Shakespeare giving a kind of proto-Machiavellian or even a neo-Machiavellian understanding of politics and power. So the second half of Shakespeare's history plays is all about what the history plays say about the nature of power politics. Okay, so it's you can see that it's related to what the new historicism is doing, but it kind of strips out all of the bullshit, the Marxist stuff, the subversion, and instead what I was trying to do was to actually outline what Shakespeare was trying to say. And my reading was a little bit different from many standard readings of those plays, which basically said Shakespeare was trying to reassert the great chain of being. I think Shakespeare would ideally have loved the great chain of being, but he picks a really unhappy period in English history to uphold the great chain, and he's actually showing what happens in a kind of fallen Machiavellian world of realpolitik. Okay, so hopefully you can see how my very first book actually has themes which anticipate some of my later work, even though some of my kind of assumptions and thinking was not fully developed back when I wrote it in my mid 20s when I actually wrote that book, in the late 2000s. You can see how my basic interest in Machiavelli, in politics, in power, they're all already there. And I would say that my reading of the Henry the Sixth plays and the Henry the Fourth plays, Richard the Second, I think they hold up pretty well. You know, I mean, if I was to write that today, there'd probably be a few things I'd change. But generally, I think the work I did there stands up pretty well. Now, one of the things that happened when I was trying to get a publisher for my PhD thesis was that, they said, I remember getting advice, so you know, when you're trying to get published, only approach one publisher at once, and they could take 18 months to get back to you. Okay. Now, I at that time, I was working. I was working in the city, and I was kind of flying from New York to Chicago. So I was working like in the financial, with financial types and with market data and reference data people, which is, it was a different world, right? And I was kind of already at that point, I was already thinking like, maybe I shouldn't have even been in it. I kind of like this different world. I like the world of finance. And, kind of like some of these investment banker types that I'm talking to all the time. And I was seriously thinking at that point, you know, this is kind of an interesting world, this world of finance. I could get into this. I was making contacts and so on and so forth. But also in the process of that, it really gave me an education in economics, in, you know, I got a real interest in economics at that time from working in the city, from the people I was exposed to, from the conversations I was having, from, you know, the understanding that I was developing of, you know, the world of commodity markets, and equities, and all of that stuff, high frequency trading, and you know, the importance of market data and all these sorts of things I was you know, working on in that job that I had. And one of the things that I remember is that I was thinking like, these guys aren't, they would never in a million years, salespeople. Like I met some like really hard-nosed salespeople in that job. I had to work with salespeople. I had to give briefs and you know, manage projects, or you know, some you know, different type of marketers and salespeople. I mean, I remember distinctly that job. I worked in an office, and they had, you know, those glass doors. Glass office meeting rooms, right? So people were having a meeting, but you could see into the meeting, right? I remember salespeople going in there with a publisher and getting an absolute bollocking. You know, they were soundproof glass, but you could hear them shouting even through the glass. I was thinking, this is a different world. It's like more like Glenn Ross or something. But you know, my personality, I kind of dug all of that. I was like, this is kind of cool. Like, kind of you know, this is good. These people are being judged on their results, which doesn't happen in academia. This is something that you can excel at quickly, and your results speak for yourselves, and your work kind of matters. And so I kind of there were aspects of that world that appealed to me. But one of the things can people hear me? People are saying my mic is bad. I don't have water in my mic. Can people hear me? Can people hear me? I can't. Press one to actually hear me properly. Why are you saying my mic is knackered? Is my mic fine? I don't know, because everybody's just talking about mops all the time. Okay, cutting out here and there. Well, I can't do much about that. I mean, maybe it's because of the internet connection or something. Anyway, it's cutting in and out. Choppy, some echo. Right, well, I'm just going to carry on. You'll have to, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. So anyway, one of the things I learned there, because I learned a lot on doing that job, I was writing commercial copy, I was working with marketers, I was involved in marketing campaigns, I was working with salespeople. I learned a lot, and it was a fast work environment. And I was also in daily contact with people working at a much higher level, you know, VPs at Bank of America and people like this. So anyway, my PhD was in, but I needed to get the books. I needed to get my book published, right? So it's one thing finishing a PhD, another thing getting it published as a book. And in academia, everybody was like, oh, yeah, you can only write to one publisher at a time. And, you know, they won't like it if you write to multiple people at once. I was thinking, like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, that. Like, who, like, fuck that. I'm going to write to them all. I wrote to them all. I wrote to five at once. And I remember that I had offers from three of them. And I had to say to one, you know, I can't do that. Now, they always said that Oxford University Press, Cambridge University Press have like an 18-month to two-year turnaround. Well, I'm not going to go with them. That's too long. I'm not waiting fucking 18 months for my book to come out. Fuck that. So I went with Edinburgh University Press because they had a fast turnaround, basically. And what happened was that Bloomsbury, at the time it was called Continuum, there was a press called Continuum who had the publisher there at the time, the head of their editor, or I can't remember, their publishing editor, I think they called it. He was very interested in turning what I'd done into a guide of some kind for students, like, rather than this publishing the whole PhD, what he wanted was a book that would basically explain, like, what is new historicism, what is cultural materialism, what are some of the critiques of them, in kind of a book for students type thing. Okay. And, well, I was thinking, like, okay, what I could do here is I could say yes to that one, and I could say yes to that one. So I ended up turning my PhD into two books, which nobody, almost nobody does that, but I did. So I turned my PhD into two books. Very rare move within academia. So I arrived at my first job ready with having published two books. Not done. What had happened is that over the course of writing my PhD, my supervisor basically, I wrote about 20 or 30,000 words that I ended up binning, basically. I ended up binning about 30,000 words from my finished PhD. For whatever reason, they were, you know, we decided they weren't necessary, or I remember him being quite cross that I was like, no, I'd rather bin them. So I had about 30,000 words in the bin, although obviously I didn't put them in the bin, I saved them. And the second book there, Shakespeare and Contemporary Theory, New Historicism, Cultural Materialism, was basically raw materials for that book were in that 30,000 words, which I had binned. Basically, the thesis that I wrote took too long to get going because I was doing too much like introductory stuff. And I felt that the final thing could kind of pitch itself at a higher level and didn't need that introductory material there. But it would work better for the student guide. So that is how that second book came about. And within academia, I would say that second book is probably my most read book. If I go on Google Scholar, probably my most cited book is that one. Yeah, it has 90 citations on Google Scholar, that book. Whereas my Shakespeare's History Plays has 50. So it's my most cited book in academia as well. But it was also the most bought, most read, most copies sold was that second book. And then the actual thesis, the Shakespeare's History Plays, you know, it also did quite well, but it was that was more of a monograph, and I think just more people. There's a guy in the chat saying he read them both. Yeah, I mean, if you've done Shakespeare at university, you probably come across one of those two books if you're going to come across any of my books. Those two, right? Now the second book, I mean, they were both reviewed, you know, fairly widely in journals and things. And I remember that one reviewer said that Shakespeare and Contemporary Theory was a polemic disguised as a student guide, because there was too much of my politics in there, which was basically low-key anti-leftist. And he picked up on that. But not everybody did. A lot of people just kind of said, well, these are good works, right? So, yes. What else? My third book was Shakespeare and Cognition. Now, one of the things I wanted to do, things that the new historicists hated, was the idea that the characters in Shakespeare's plays alluded to real people. Whereas I thought, and I have always thought, that Shakespeare's plays work best if you think of the characters as real people. So I wanted to revive the kind of character and action approach of a critic called A.C. Bradley, who was around in the late 19th century, early 20th century, kind of Victorian gentleman. And I liked that approach. I wanted to date it and try to find ways of bringing that back in a trendy, modern, new way. And one of the books that has been very influential on my own thinking was Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. I don't know if anyone read that book. It's a kind of book on behavioral economics and also on kind of how the human mind works. Intuition comes first and reasoning follows. System one thinking and system two thinking, right? And I thought that this book by Daniel Kahneman could be kind of integrated in an update of A.C. Bradley's character and action approach to Shakespeare. And we should be able to see aspects of what Kahneman is saying in Shakespeare's work, because I believe that Shakespeare is a very intuitive writer, a very system one writer, and not a very system two writer. And this is one of the reasons, I mean, I believe that Shakespeare, that's one of the reasons that I believe that he's so highly rated, because he gets what makes human beings tick, right? He understands that people aren't motivated a lot by reasoning. They're not motivated by theoretical abstract ideas. They're motivated by their intuitions and their emotions, and they can be persuaded and misled by appeals to these kind of non-logical, if you want, non-rational ways of being. And this should be relevant for anyone who's interested in, if you've read Populist Illusion, I talk about Pareto. Pareto came to these kind of same view of human nature that Daniel Kahneman talks about in The Mind and Society, when he says that human action is basically non-rational, non-logical. And the ideology follows is a post hoc ideology is a post hoc rationalization of something that is more deeply felt at an instinct at an instinctual level. There were other people who thought along these lines as well. You know, who was it who said reason is the slave to the passions? David Hume. Hume thought along these lines, and I have been very strongly influenced by this way of understanding human beings myself. I think it's basically true. I think it's very easily provable that it's true. You can see it everywhere. So this is actually very central to my entire worldview, this insight from Kahneman. And that third book was a kind of attempt to introduce this way of thinking into Shakespeare scholarship, which has had some success, I would say. It's had some people have talked about this and have followed that up. I mean, things take a long time to happen in academia, which is one of the reasons that I was always quite impatient with it. You know, you'll release a book and you may not get the reaction for like 6 or 7 years, you know, but slowly starts to filter through and people start talking about it. You know, 8 years later, you see, you know, you've had some sort of impact. The timeline is a bit slow for me. I'm actually more suited, I think, to the kind of space we're in now, which is a bit more dynamic, and you know, you can see the ideas filter through quicker, I think, you know, in these online spaces than in actual academia. But that's something for another day. Another book that I didn't really want to write but was approached to write was Shakespeare and New Historicist Theory. Ard and Shakespeare were doing a series. By 2017, I was kind of seen as an expert on New Historicism within the discipline. Still am, you know. You can still, if you pick up any book on New Historicism, I'll be cited there somewhere. You know, I've written the Oxford entries for on New Historicism, various chapters in kind of standard textbooks and things are written by me on this topic, because, you know, I did a whole thesis on it, so therefore I know a lot about that topic. This is what, you know, that's what becoming a kind of subject matter expert is within a discipline. And so they were doing this series called the Arden Shakespeare were doing this series on theory, and they approached me to write this book on New Historicism. And I was like, you know, you do realize I've got two books on this already, so what else can I say, basically? But I did it, and believe it or not, I found new things to say. The introduction to that book is very interesting if you're interested in how some of the postmodern stuff and the deconstructionist stuff and Foucault and all these characters and postmodernism in general infiltrated into history, capital H history department. You know, there's a guy called G.R. Elton, who I mentioned before, David Starkey's mentor. And I basically tell the story of how his battles basically with a lot of these characters back in the day, and how ultimately he was fighting a rearguard action. He won initially, but in the long run, he lost. By the time he was retiring, they were taking over the department that he used to run, for example. And in some ways, that fourth book is better written than my first one. I think I was a better writer in 2017 than I was in 2007, basically, when I wrote that first book. So I had like another decade of experience behind me when I wrote that fourth book. So it's more readable and more polished and less kind of, I just leveled up more by the time I'd written that book. So if you're interested in that, that would be one to have a look at. It's also a lot cheaper, I think. It was a paperback, whereas that first book was a hardback and is, I think, remains very expensive. Okay, so then I wanted to explore the intuition and reasoning stuff more. So I wrote a fifth book called Shakespeare's Moral Compass, where I don't know if you've heard of Jonathan Haidt. He wrote a book called The Righteous Mind. And in The Righteous Mind, he explores this idea that all kind of moral feeling starts with a gut instinctual emotion. And then all of the reasoning and it comes afterwards. Your emotional elephant moves first, and then you post hoc rationalize it after the fact. I was very interested in this. It's called Moral Foundations Theory. And in fact, when I first made this channel back in November 2016, that was before I wrote this book. I wrote Shakespeare's Moral Compass after I was already on YouTube. But a lot of my early videos are about Jonathan Haidt and about moral foundations theory. If you're a channel member, you can go back and you can watch those videos where I'm talking about Jonathan Haidt. And I wrote to Jonathan Haidt. He praised the book. If you pick up Shakespeare's Moral Compass, he has the blurb at the back and says, everything scholarship should be, which I was kind of proud of at that time. And through Jonathan Haidt, basically, I joined this thing called the Heterodox Academy. And he put me in touch with the Quillette people, Claire Lehman, and people like that. And so I started writing for them around this time through Jonathan Haidt, basically, right? I was very interested in the moral foundation stuff. And what I tried to do in Shakespeare's Moral Compass is I tried to take those six moral foundations. Or then again, authority. What are those six moral foundations? Fairness, authority, fairness. It's been a while. Somebody jog my memory. Chat is useless. All they're doing is talking about mops in chat. So I can't go to the chat for help. Anyway, there are six moral foundations, and in Shakespeare's Moral Compass, I kind of asked, like, what is Shakespeare's morals? Does he have a moral compass? If I took him through the moral foundations theory test, if we took his plays through those tests, what would come out the other end? You know, would he be a liberal? Would he be a conservative? Would he over-index in care, the care harm axis, or on liberty? Or like, what would Shakespeare look like on the moral foundations? So that is what I tried to do in Shakespeare's Moral Compass. And I think it was an interesting book. There's a lot of stuff in there. In the first half, I talk about Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell is in there a lot. Remember, the Conflict of Visions. Remember that book? The Vision of the Anointed. Because I had seen that the Jonathan Haidt stuff, where he talks about the left being blind to some of these other moral foundations and to leaning only on the care heart principle, and Sowell's work and some other stuff. So there's a lot of that sort of material in the first half of that book. And basically, I made an argument that Shakespeare's plays basically are, you know, he comes out as more or less conservative, traditionalist at the end of the day. And when that book was reviewed, I wouldn't say it wasn't controversial, but some of the reviewers were like, well, yeah, this guy is pretty socially conservative, this Harvini chap, you know. This is a pretty socially conservative book. And I mean, one of the things that I think people objected to was that I low-key defend master-servant relationships in the authority chapter. I talk about the importance of social bonds, right? Already influenced by people like Carlyle by this point in my, you know, this is 2018, I wrote this book, 2017, 2018. So I'd already had contact with the, you know, reactionary ideas by this point. And my defense of authority as a kind of positive authority that is not simply oppression, the fact that I called modern scholars' understanding of power as simply being oppression as childish and naive, you know, I think that some of the reviewers took umbrage at that. Yeah, I mean, I think that Shakespeare's Moral Compass is still well worth reading. In fact, I mean, I defend all of my work. I think Shakespeare's Moral Compass basically is a book that I could easily have written like yesterday. There's almost nothing in there that I wouldn't defend now. In fact, the only thing I would disavow in Shakespeare's Moral Compass is a footnote that I put in there about biological racial differences. I basically had this kind of footnote where I quoted this guy saying, like, you know, within group differences are bigger than between group differences, therefore, like, racism real type thing. I shouldn't have done that. I should have just not had that footnote in there. But because I was talking about evolutionary theory, Darwinism, and these sorts of things, taking a kind of more Darwinistic approach to these are kind of alarm bells within academia for obvious reasons. And I included that footnote basically to say, well, you know, I'm not going to touch the race stuff. I shouldn't have done, I should have just left it, period, you know. Then I, at the same time as that, I was into my libertarian Austrian school stuff. People who follow this channel will know I had an interest in Austrian economics. It goes back to my interest in economics more broadly, which goes back to experiences in the city and so on. And I wanted to have a whole book where I try to kind of rescue classical liberalism from the excesses of liberalism more generally. Now, I'm not going to say that it's a book-length cope, because I think that many parts of that book still hold up. There's a whole chapter on Burnham, Machiavelli, elite theory and stuff in there. Second chapter is all about elite theory and works as a great precursor to Populist Illusion, if you read it. I also, in that book, try to synthesize the stuff I've been talking about in Shakespeare's Moral Compass and Shakespeare and Cognition, i.e., so if you want to put it this way, the negative vision, the critique of leftism, is in the first two books, the New Historicist Theory one. That is basically critiques of Marxism and Marx and neo-Marxist theory. And the Cognition and the Moral Compass books are more like positive vision, more like kind of, you know, well, if we're not going to do Marxism, what should we do, right? And in Defenders of Liberty, I try to put a lot of that stuff together and give a definition of what I call human nature in that book, which includes things like in-group preference, moral tribes, all things that are relevant to the discussions that we have now. So my definition of human nature in that book, is a very condensed version of what was in all of my previous stuff. So there is a kind of, even though I'm talking about economics in this fifth book and I've left Shakespeare behind, a lot of the work I did in the first five books makes its way into Defenders of Liberty. It's a bridge, if you want to put it that way, to some of the stuff I've done more recently. Hold on a second. I just spotted someone in the chat who shouldn't be there. I talk about, I try to synthesize my view of human nature in that book. And then I then try to make human nature work with classical liberalism. And I try to argue that classical liberalism should be realist and not utopian. That it needs to be aware of elite theory, needs to be aware of the limits of human nature, and work with those as opposed to working against those. Okay. So it was my attempt to rescue liberalism, that book, from a realist elite theory pilled perspective. Whether it succeeds or fails is up to you guys. But since writing it, I came to see libertarians and liberalism in general and people who are into liberalism as basically being utopian themselves. Now, when push comes to shove, they are on the utopian side and not on the realist side. I would prefer them to be. And my critiques of libertarianism are still all there. There's a, on the channel, you can find them. There's a retrospective video that goes through my critiques of liberalism and libertarianism, basically as the handmaiden socialism. But I would still say Defenders of Liberty is a decent bridging book to read. Good, kind of catches my thought in transition, if you want to put it that way, to being closer to where it is today. Although I would say that the kind of more reactionary or conservative stuff is already there in Shakespeare's Moral Compass. Defenders of Liberty is basically working out, trying to make peace with liberalism. And ultimately, in Populist Illusion, which a lot of you have, which is one of the books that a lot of you have read, I basically say, yeah, you can't save liberalism from itself for all the reasons they point out in Populist Illusion. I wanted to have this idea that the based world could be created by small libertarianism, and that through what they call spontaneous order, you would get something that looks like Based World, right? The freedom of association alone, you know, free of big government, so on and so forth, would get something that looks closer to Based World, is the basic idea, right? Trouble is, that's never going to happen. It's just never going to happen. And Populist Illusion basically is like a whole book on why that's the case. Ultimately, elite theory and politics defeats economics. Politics comes before economics. Is the, you know, one of the chief lessons of Populist Illusion. And it took me a while to see that in full. Defenders of Liberty is a book where I'm struggling between a liberal worldview and a sort of worldview that I have now, trying to make it work. And ultimately, I don't think I could make it work. But maybe somebody one day will read Defenders of Liberty and be like, actually, you know, if he if we followed what, like, libertarianism could work if we did it like the way this guy said. If we made libertarianism this, then it would be based, you know, then that could lead to Based World. Trouble is, I just don't think that from where we are now, it's achievable. And there's a paradox in liberalism itself, which is that it requires power, a monopoly of power vested in one government, or if you want to take the ANCAP world, you still end up with a de facto government. It's just private, right? There's still a monopoly of violence, ultimately. It requires some vestige of power. Power wants to grow. Power wants to centralize. Power wants to multiply. It's trying to reach, like, let's say you have power one. It's trying to reach power 10. It's always trying to reach 10. It's trying to become Stalin all the time. And in the end, you have to get your hands on the guns and just try to make the government do stuff you want, because the idea that we need to leave it to the organic forces of the free market is a myth. It's just never going to work out that way, because there's always going to be somebody who wants to put their hand on the scales, tilt them in their favor. I'll always be an organized minority. I want to get over on the disorganized mass. And liberalism fails to give an adequate answer to that problem, basically. So, yeah, Defenders of Liberty was my attempt to save it. Populist Illusion was my conclusion that actually it can't be saved, and actually, I'm going to stick the knife in 100 more times by writing this book. And then finally, Prophets of Doom, which came out earlier this year, is a book on cyclical history. In many ways, a natural sequel to Populist Illusion. And I've given many interviews on those last two books, which I won't bore you with them. Given by the state of the chat, who have talked about mops for 78 minutes exclusively. Nobody was interested in the stream. So I will just, they're just absolutely not interested at all. So I don't know why I bothered. There's a couple of, there's one super chat from Third Man who says, not related to the stream, but have you read the sci-fi series, The Culture, by Ian M. Banks? And if so, what do you think of its post-scarcity utopia? I haven't, Third Man, because I don't really read novels at all. And I'm not that into sci-fi, so I'm afraid I have no thoughts on that. I'll have a look at Entropy. There's one in there by Narco Republican, who says December the 4th marks the birthday of Francisco Franco, Bahamonde Cordillo, by the grace of God. So there we go. It's Francisco Franco's birthday today. Given that nobody has any other comments that aren't anything to do with mops, you will, you know, this is your one chance to ask me any questions about any of these books. But nobody has an interest in that. So I'll just remind people once again, my Vax Glide Poo gets 25% off all courses, and I'll get out of here. Spasticus Autisticus says, what do you make of Hobbes nowadays? Any good secondary lit on him? Well, Defenders of Liberty has a chapter on Hobbes. So you can, there's a lot of good secondary literature on him. The guy, I seem to remember the guy's name is he's like a neocon. So what, kind of neocon light sort of guy. Who's the big Hobbes scholar? Forget his name now. He writes on Machiavelli as well. He's like a big Hobbes scholar. What's his name, that guy? Skinner, Quentin Skinner. He seems to be the big Hobbes man, right? And there's some kind of low-key based stuff in the works of Quentin Skinner. He writes on Machiavelli as well. I used Quentin Skinner quite a bit in that chapter and in my explorations of Machiavelli. Hobbes, of course, is very important as basically an influence on Carl Schmitt. Carl Schmitt is basically a Hobbesian. So a lot of the stuff that we talk about in Schmitt is actually there in Thomas Hobbes as well. And some of the conclusions that, I mean, one of my most watched videos ever is on Thomas Hobbes. If you have a look on my channel, Hobbes, it's got 120,000 views. That it's called Thomas Hobbes's Argument for Absolute Monarchy, which I wrote 4 years ago. Hobbes is, he has good arguments. What I would say is that the stronger version of that argument is by Robert Filmer and Mike at Imperium Press brought out a version of Filmer, which I would recommend you buy. And that Filmer and De Maistre give stronger arguments for monarchy than Thomas Hobbes does. Because ultimately Thomas Hobbes is, he's already kind of weirdly liberal, if that makes any sense. There's a kind of proto-liberalism in Hobbes. He's already kind of weirdly materialist. As is Machiavelli, which is one of the things I argue in Defenders of Liberty. That's what I would say about Hobbes. Brulam says, I'm smoking a Hoyo Epicure 2 while listening. Have you had it? Thoughts? Well, I love a Hoyo, Brulam. I actually have run out of Epi 2s at the moment. I have an unsmoked thus far box of 10 Epicure Especials, which I have. I actually took a video the other day, like a video tour of my humidor, and I just haven't had a chance to turn it into a video yet, but I was going to give a little tour through my humidor because I basically have now completed my little collection of kind of standard Cubans that I want, you know, my go-to collection. Unfortunately, it's bloody freezing here, so it's not very good cigar smoking weather at the moment. Not only has it been cold, but the past day or so it's been raining as well. I have not I've not had a cigar for, I had like one cigar in like two, like almost a month or something like that. So anyway, I will do that soon. Marty said, I mean, the Epi 2 though, people always ask me like, what's a good first cigar? The Hoyo Epi 2 is a very good first cigar, I'd say. But it's also one that is good when you're experienced as well. It's a good beginner cigar, but it's also a good experience cigar as well, because it's complex. Marty says, next book. My next book will be called The Boomer Truth Regime, Marty. It will be a kind of... I mean, it's meant to be the third part of a trilogy, the start of the Populist Revolution. I'm having a lot of conceptual problems with what this book is going to look like. I'm not happy. I don't want it to be a revisionist history book, right? I.e., I don't want it to be a book that says, everything you know about World War II is a lie, here's the truth. Because that's not really what I'm getting at. What I want to do is I want to kind of get inside mindset of truth and deconstruct it almost from the inside out. And I want to look at its myths and narratives as it's captured in popular culture, in songs, in movies, things like that. And I want to kind of use a lot of the tools that Populist Illusion and Prophets of Doom would teach, essentially, as a kind of applied analysis to take apart Boomer Truth piece by piece and show its kind of inner workings. I also, during the course of that book, want to critique the version of individualism that Boomer Truth pushes, and to expose it basically as being like fundamentally stupid approach to the world. I also kind of want to show how pernicious the view that Hitler is the ultimate evil is, not as a rehabilitation of Hitler, but how this is used as a structuring principle in the world that we live in. Trouble is, all of that is quite a tall order in one book. It's hard to know where to start it. It's hard to know what to cover, what not to cover. At the moment, what I'm doing, when I get time, having a family makes time difficult always. But I'm actually reading books on boomers. I'm reading books on World War II. I'm reading books on everything, basically, to try to find an angle, to get a shape, to find an angle. I mean, another part of the Boomer Truth regime is the kind of exalted and special status of Jews in it, who are kind of like a Schmittian exception. And the Holocaust, the ultimate, as the uniquely evil event in history. I mean, I just don't know how to discuss all of this within one book. And I haven't yet. Something hasn't clicked with me yet as to how I'm going to do it. There's a way of discussing these things that will make it work as a book, right? And I want it to be a book that your mother could read, if that makes any sense. How to do it, I don't know yet. Usually what happens is that something clicks. It's just taking longer than usual with this one. I haven't found my true thesis with Boomer Truth Regime yet, I don't think. So, yeah, because I want to discuss all the fun stuff as well, like Gen X Daria and, like, you know, shit hippies and stuff too. I wanted to retain the fun of my old videos, but there's some serious stuff I want to discuss in Boomer Shoes regime as well. And it's a way of doing this that doesn't make the book trite, right? I want the book to not feel out of place next to Prophets of Doom and Populist Illusion. Does that make sense? So I want it to have continuity with them, to have some more quote unquote fun element, because I do think Prophets of Doom is quite is not a fun book, right? It's not. It's just not fun. Subject matter's not fun. The whole book is not fun. Populist Illusion is not a fun book either. So this third book is going to have more fun. But I also want it to be not so fun that it seems out of place next to the last ones, right? It's hard. I don't know how to put it all together yet. Devastator says, well, he's just given a $2.99 super sticker. Brulam says, I'm moving to South Africa for a few years. I can report from the Dark Continent. I loved your books, and I need to read the ones about Shakespeare. That's an interesting move, Brulam. Why are you going to South Africa, sir? You're living in Canada now. I mean, is that not from the frying pan into the fire? Or have you got like a work reason to go there? Lux Life says, which of your two Shakespeare books would you recommend for a theatre major and fellow scholar? I like Shakespeare's Moral Compass. Shakespeare's Moral Compass was a hell of a lot of work for me. And it was, I really wanted it to be when I was writing it, I had a feeling in my bones that this would be my final word on Shakespeare. This book would be my last contribution to the field. Now, given that I was working as a scholar back then, it's weird how these things work, right? I don't want to sound pretentious, but was that God talking to me or what? But because I've since not written any further Shakespeare books. But it really depends on what they're interested in. Maybe that one and the previous one, the New Historicist Theory one. But yeah, it's up to. It really is. It's a bit, really. Mr. Spoon says, it's interesting how the university departments were captured. I listened to Starkey talking to right-wing UCL students today, and he sounded like he was engaging in containment. The subject of the question seemed radical to me. That's interesting. Starkey will be well aware of this because G.R. Elton, as I mentioned, was his mentor and his hero in many ways. His academic hero was G.R. Elton. And Elton spent his entire late career fighting against the postmoderns. And some people think all this stuff that I've, the Shakespeare stuff I've done is a waste of time, right? Which is fine. It's your prerogative. Maybe you think all of academia is a waste of time. Maybe. What I was trying to do was to do my bit, basically, to give a roadmap to people who want to find this stuff out. Anybody out there who wants to understand what the actual long march through the institutions look like, will get a. If you read my first two books and the third and the fourth one, there, those three books, the Shakespeare's History plays, the Contemporary Theory one, and the New Historicist Theory one, it will basic and There's also a chapter on cultural materialism. I forget where it was published now. That's explained. Like, it looks at this when Cambridge tried to hire this left wing guy, and the department were like saying, like, several professors took their last stand over this Marxist being hired to Cambridge, and they were like, if you hire these guys, we're all going to resign. And there was a massive fight over it, right? But the guy ended up being hired ultimately in the 80s, and this was a massive, this was a big deal, like, within the discipline and so on. Now, you may think that these things don't matter, but they actually do matter, because whole generations of students, what people call woke today and all of this sort of stuff, it has its roots in what happens on these campuses and how these different departments are captured, and how people like G.R. Elton and those professors at Cambridge and Oxford and many other places were basically hounded out. Roger Scruton hounded out. Thomas Sowell hounded out. Me fired, ultimately. You know, that's basically what happened. But when you have a situation where there isn't any scope for dissent within the discipline, so it's, you know, and then people wonder, well, how is it now that, you know, the entire higher education sector is like 99% Democrat or whatever? We lose these. I try to tell the story, but, you know, people don't want to, people would rather have a go at me and call me names than engage with any of this stuff seriously, you know. Brulam says, I like H-Up-1-2 and the Connoisseur 2 better than the Hoyo 2. All excellent. Have you read Worms of Foundations? I recommended recently. You mentioned being interested, and I look forward to your breakdown. It's definitely on the list, Brulam. I haven't actually got it yet. I have to remind myself to get that. In fact, if you could, if you're on Twitter, if you send it to me, I will. I'll pick it up. I'll buy it. Thanks for reminding me. In terms of Upman 2 and Connie 2, I actually have got Connoisseur 1, which is a good. That's a really good cigar as well. Lovely kind of. It's got that shortbread. Yep, shortbread. But it's also got a lovely kind of smoky tobacco thing going on as well. My favorite Upman, of course, is the Connoisseur A, and of course the Sir Winston, of which I've only ever had one, but boy, was it amazing. So, and Brulam says Canada isn't dark enough. I need the 60 red rum per 100k stress to feel alive. No, it's a work reason. So basically, he's taking a job in South Africa. Marty says, how was Boomer Truth distributed as an idea? Well, I would say, Marty, that its chief mechanism was mass culture. And I think the difference between Boomer Truth and what people call woke, right, is that Boomer Truth was always a kind of a government-led mass culture thing. Push through pop records and movies, and popular culture. Whereas what people call woke was always, I think, an elite university-driven thing. Ultimately, coming out of a lot of this stuff I've been talking about on this screen, and then it filtered from the universities into a mass culture in a really awkward way, which has caused massive social problems, because its sensibilities are not very conducive to mass culture, really, because they're so divisive. I think woke is a terrible ruling ideology. Boomer Truth is a much more successful ruling ideology. One of the most successful ruling ideologies of time, I would say. That is why I want to focus on that. And one of the things I'm reading a lot of these books on boomers, there's this moment in them where they kind of pivot and they start talking about woke stuff. Some books on boomers. And one of the things I want to do in Boomer Truth Regime is not talk about woke. I want to keep the focus laser-like on boomer truth ideas, not on woke. Because ultimately, I don't believe that wokery is the natural outgrowth of boomer truthery. I think that in some ways, wokery is built on a critique that implicitly rejects a lot of boomer truth ideas. So I don't want to turn into, I don't want the book to be yet another book of woke bashing, right? Woke has got a lot of problems and it's a terrible thing and I'm dead against it. But ultimately it's weak versus, it's weak as a rooting ideology. Whereas Boomer Truth is seductive and powerful and is ultimately responsible for why we're here. Woke is not responsible for why we're here. It is the bitter fruit. It is the consequence, the symptom of why we're here. The ultimate root cause is Boomer Truth. So that's one of the things I want to do in my book that sets it apart from some of the other stuff that's out there. I will say I've been pleasantly surprised by some of these books on boomers, though. What's her name? Helen. The one by Helen Stewart is her name. What's her name? What's that book of boomers by woman's name? Helen Andrews. I mean, Helen Andrews on paper looks like a kind of National Review neocon type, but she's actually that book on boomers she wrote is good. It's good. And the tweet for Foundations by Renee Wormster. Thank you very much, Boolab. I will pick that up shortly. On entry, that is it. Unless anybody has any other comments in the... Helen Andrews actually follows me on Twitter, although she's never actually interacted with me in any way. So... There we go. And Prudham says, extra reason to prioritize the book following. All right. Daniel says, which did you most enjoy writing? Which did you learn the most writing? Which is a favorite one you've enjoyed writing? If you could only buy one, which would it be? Prophets of Doom was not enjoyable to write. It was a fucking struggle. And was a lot of hard work and was grim. My experience of writing Prophets of Doom was grim, I would say. Populist Delusion came very easily because I was already bubbling with these ideas and it was just a case of getting them down. So that was quite an easier process. I mean, every book has a struggle, right? Every book has a struggle. But that one was easier than Prophets of Doom. In terms of stuff, I learned a lot writing Shakespeare's Moral Compass. There's a whole chapter on there on the Renaissance and the Reformation. There's a lot of history in there. There's some theology in there. There's stuff on Aquinas in there. I mean, I remember going down to the library and consulting the 60-volume Summa Theologica. I think, you know, holy shit. Who's going to read? How can anybody read the Summa Theologica? It's 60 volumes. And then kind of understanding that actually, you know, you can probably like zoom in on a few different ones. So like a coin, a scholarship, its own thing. And then there's a lot of other stuff when I was learning about master-servant relationships, how they actually function, what ideal ones were, what was the scope of chat to the king, right? So there's the great chain of being, but within that, you've got a moral duty to tell the king if he's being flat. Like, how far does that stretch? How far is the king within his rights to have you killed, basically, for backchatting? You know, stuff like that. There's a lot of those things that I learned writing that book. So in terms of total things learned, Moral Compass has the most, I would say. Maybe that one. In terms of which ones you should buy is the large, you know, Prophets of Doom and Prophets of Illusion, obviously. So, yeah. It says, have you found it increasingly hard to get your books published, or has it been relatively plain sailing for all of them? No, every single book I've ever had published has been plain sailing and easy. I think this comes from my ability to write in a language that marketers and publishers understand, to be super duper clear, to give bullet points and USPs, and basically understanding what they're looking for. This is just why business savvy, right? There's a whole art to a book proposal, which I won't go into on this stream, but I'm pretty good at writing book proposals. And I don't think I've ever had one turned down. Never had a book proposal turned down. Prophets of Doom, if you're interested, by the way, was originally written for Palgrave. The proposal was written for Palgrave Macmillan, and who did Defenders of Liberty. And they were very interested in publishing Prophets of Doom. Trouble is, Palgrave did one of the worst jobs ever at bringing out Defenders of Liberty. It was too expensive. It's still too expensive. They said they'd bring it out in paperback and hardback straight away, and they didn't. The paperback, I don't know if it ever came out. What else happened? So it was just too expensive, torn and short. And they didn't do anything to promote it or anything, basically. So, I also did the Shakespearean Cognition book with Palgrave. That also, like, sunk the trace. So I was like, right, what's the point of writing these books if you're just going to kind of mishandle them coming out, right? And I don't like their covers either. They gave me very little control over the covers. Every other book, I had a say in what the cover would be. With Palgrave, they were like, yeah, pick one of the pre-made patterns. Oh, right. Okay, I'll have the one that looks like a flower then. I generally didn't find the experience of working with them happy. So I went with other publishers, basically. With Populist Illusion, I thought Mike, well, he gave, you know, I wanted to help try to, like, make Imperium Press a really good house press for all of us, and to try to kind of give it as much of a boost as I could. And I still love Imperium Press. I think they're brilliant and have been the best publisher I've worked with, I would say. The guys who did Prophets of Doom, the imprint, have been good as well. They've been good at too. They've been extremely proactive in promoting the book. Probably the most proactive in promoting that book of any publisher that I've had. So they're a good press as well. They've brought out stuff with Dutton and others too. So next book will be with, you know, one of those two. I mean, there's a chance that Boom Truth Regime is too difficult to write in one book, and it actually ends up becoming two books. But I don't know yet. We'll see. Brulam says, do not end the stream. Give me 2 minutes. Okay. All right. I'll see if I can take another question then. Just take a question from the chat to not end the stream. Let's see if there's any other. Is the Populist Delusion cover based on the Managerial Revolution cover? No, it's based on the original cover of Mosca's The Ruling Class. Mosca's The Ruling Class. My copy of it has got a triangle on the front. And what happened was is that Mike was like, what do you want as the cover? And I said, I want a cover that's like a 70s textbook with a triangle on the front. And he then sent me all these different graphic designs. There was one that was red and it had a black triangle. It looked like the White Stripes video. I said, that looks too fashy. And then there was this one. I was like, that is awesome. That's one of my favorite covers ever. So Populist Delusion has the best cover of any of my books, in my opinion, because I love the 70s textbook feel of it. The Prophet of Doom, what do you want as a cover? I said I want a rogues gallery of the Prophets of Doom all in a row like that. And I had in mind, it was a Batman thing that I saw once, an Adam West Batman, where it was like Penguin, Joker, Riddler, you know, they were all there. And I wanted a version of that. And I was very clear on my idea of that. And they sent me a number of ones back. And this is the one that we went with. The very first book, they were like, what do you want the front cover to be? I was like, this is a picture of Richard II's skull. I want it to be that skull. I think skulls are cool. And they were like, all right. So hence, it's a skull. The Moral Compass, that is a statue of King Lear, which I thought was cool. I think it's in Chicago, that statue, memory serves. I could be wrong. And I wanted that. I thought it looked cool. And so they went with that. Both of those books came out with Edinburgh University Press, who are another really good press to deal with. I had a really happy time working with both of them. The Bloomsbury covers, the Shakespeare and Contemporary Theory one, they basically sent me an email one day and said, our artist has come up with this. Do you like it? This would be your cover. And I was like, okay, fine. I still don't know what that cover is about, by the way. It's just a kind of conceptual cover. It's like a kind of eye and a moon. Somebody holding a feather pen. It's kind of random cover. With the New Historicist one, they basically sent me a series of covers that looked like sperm. And they were like, pick one of these. Do you want number one, number two, number eight, or whatever? I was like, okay, let's go with this one. And that ended up being that. So generally, those are my least favorite covers, by the way, where they would just say, here is some templates and pick one. You know, so there we are. Can you make a playlist rewriting of Peterson's Conservative Manifesto? I don't know. I mean, just type in Peterson. There's only like two of them, I think, or three of them. Somebody likes the Shakespeare Cognition cover the most. I mean, it's all right. It kind of looks all right. Shakespeare and Cognition is a very short book because it was written as an essay or a journal. And it was a bit too long to be a journal article. So I put it into this journal and they wrote back and they said, you know, maybe it needs a bit of work. I mean, you need to cut it down. And then Palgrave came around the campus. And they're like, hey, we're doing this new series where we're publishing short books. How do you fancy it? And I was like, oh, I've just written this essay that's too long for a journal. I know. Have it. So that's how that book came about. It's kind of fortuitous in a way. But also not, because that is my least read book. Of all of my books, that is the one that I would say the fewest people have read in the world. And I never got a bloody dime for that book either. No royalties or anything. But, you know, it sold, I'm trying to remember how many libraries there are in the world. It was like one copy to every library in every like university library. That's it. So, yeah, I was pretty disappointed that Shakespeare in Cognition, of all of my books, was the one that sank without a trace most. Although there is an audio version of it on Audible by this really weirdly voiced, the voice actor who does it, a really weird voice, and he mispronounces a load of names in it as well. Like he calls Michel Foucault, for example. But, yeah, he's really, like, really drastic and thespy. There is a way of reading that on Audible if you're interested. It's very short, though. It's only like, I can't remember how long it is on Audible, but like 4 hours, something like that. So, yeah, there's an audio version of Populist Illusion as well, which may interest you. Shakespeare's Moral Compass, I recorded an audio version of myself, and the sound check was not good enough for Audible, so I may just release it on my channel if people are interested. I could just put it out, me reading the book, because I recorded it a long time ago. So those MP3s exist. So there we go. All right, Brulhan, that was 2 minutes, son. Lady of Schlott says, what do you make of all the theories that Shakespeare did not write the plays? Well, as I've said before, Schlott, there's nothing to them, really. I mean, he was a real man. He owned houses. We've got his will. We know where he lived. He was a joint stock company holder, you know, 10% in the company. He had a house with 10 fireplaces. We've got his birth date. I mean, there's just no, like, after he died, people wrote tributes about him. He had a complete collection of his plays put together. He was a star playwright in Elizabethan England. It's not like he was a made-up bloke. They made this film once. It was kind of like Shakespeare, wasn't really Shakespeare film. It was called Anonymous or something. It was called Anonymous. Is that right? Anonymous Shakespeare. Yeah. 2011 film called Anonymous. Right. Now at that time, I was working in the city, and my books had not come out by that point, and I hadn't. I wasn't in my now former job, but for some reason, the producer of that book wanted to interview me about what I made Anonymous. How that came about, I'm not really sure, but I did it. I remember going down to this studio, and they showed me this like 10-minute thing of the director of this movie, Anonymous, putting the 10 points. Roland Emmerich was his name, right? The director. And it was a video of him presenting like his top 15 points. And The arguments are awful. They're really bad. It's like, oh, Shakespeare wasn't a noble, so, and he never travelled. So how could he have known that Milan was a port? I mean, like, he read it in a book. He talked to people who had been to Milan. You know, it's just like, you know, Shakespeare was low-born, therefore he couldn't have known about the inner workings of the court. I mean, one of the things is that, well, how accurate is Shakespeare's rendition of the inner workings of the court? I mean, they're assuming that the court worked like it does in Shakespeare plays. Shakespeare made a lot of shit up. He got things wrong all the time. In his history plays, he literally conflates two historical characters into one character. Like the grandson and his grandfather are made into one character just so it fits the plot. He gets things wrong all the time, Shakespeare does. So, yeah, they're just terrible arguments made by people who are just stupid, to be honest. And I interviewed the head of the Oxfordian Society, I used to do this podcast called Shakespeare and Contemporary Theory, which I made to promote my books, to get myself known. You know, I'm good at marketing, guys. I'm good at marketing. I've always done things that other people don't do. Like, no other brand new Shakespeare scholar on the scene thought, I'm going to interview all of the big Shakespeare scholars on one podcast. I did that. Nobody else did it, right? And that's because I just have a kind of slight knack of understanding how to kind of get yourself out there a little bit, which you need to do. You need to self-promote in a way. And me doing these interviews was a way of doing that. But anyway, after that podcast was established, people then started coming to me and saying, well, I want to come on your podcast. And this guy was the chair of the Oxfordian Society. It's still out there somewhere. You're probably able to find this. And I interviewed him, and I basically allowed him to make the case. And then I kind of voiced my own kind of comebacks on it. And like one of the arguments this guy was, you know, puts forward, he was like, oh, you know, how could somebody who had written a play of the extraordinary pain and beauty of King Lear have stored grain in his loft at a time of food shortage, and he cheated on his taxes, which are things that Shakespeare actually did in real life? How could somebody of this extraordinary poetry have done something so awful? I'm like, this is not an argument, dude. This is just so stupid. I mean, Shakespeare also wrote Richard III. He also wrote Iago, who's a piece of shit, you know, in Othello, who's a villainous piece of shit. He also wrote Macbeth, which is a play about a psychopath. So it's not a good argument. What I'm saying is, it's just not a good argument, right? I mean, even King Lear is a play with extraordinary villains. Edmund the Bastard, Goneril and Regan, you know. So, none of the arguments are particularly strong. And my view is that the reason that these arguments exist is because Shakespeare is somebody that they've heard of. You don't get like Christopher Marlowe conspiracy theorists or Ben Jonson conspiracy theorists, or because nobody cares. Nobody cares. They only care because it's Shakespeare. And some people have got it into their heads that somebody of low birth, somebody of a kind of modest background that Shakespeare came from, he was a glover's son, he was a rural boy from Stratford, he left school when he was 12. They are skeptical that somebody of that background could have produced such a body of work that he did. And I just think that it's just like, why do you have this view? It's a stupid view. All of the playwrights were middle class ultimately. Ben Jonson was a bit more of a kind of bourgeois than Shakespeare was, but he was ultimately middle class. It was really those people who had to make a living, you know, and the social and historical conditions of that time meant that there was disposable income to run a theatre for the theatre industry to prosper in London. Before that time, there were travelling troupes that went around. There wasn't a market for it at that time. But there was more money around in Elizabethan England because, you know, the line was going up at that time, economically. It's just a bad argument. I mean, another thing I remember he said to me on that show, in that interview, he said, what was another argument he put forward? We don't have any reports of, if this guy, this genius Shakespeare, don't you think we have a report from one of his teachers saying this little William Shakespeare is a little bit special? We don't have a single report from a teacher saying that he was anything special in school. I mean, this is just a stupid argument. You can have a look at playwrights from 50 years ago, Joe Orton or Harold Pinter or John Osborne or any of these sorts of types. Most of them left school when they were 15, 14. It's very common for writers to leave school young and not to have glowing reports. Really common. You understand what I'm saying, right? So they're just stupid arguments. All of them are stupid arguments, which even if you think about them for a second, you wonder why they get going in the first place. So, and this isn't some like random kook. This is the head of the Oxfordian Society, the actual chairman of it, and the director of this movie. So in my view, it's not even remotely close to a good argument in the first place, right? Because not, and the biggest thing and the biggest problem, and I'll reiterate this again and again, is that the guy who they think is Shakespeare, this Earl of Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, right? He died in 1604. And Shakespeare obviously died later than that. And he's got plays like The Tempest and various other plays that came out after that time. And we know when the first performance of them was, right? So now these people have to backdate. They not only have to say that for whatever reason, this Edward de Vere, you know, secretly had Shakespeare, you know, working as a front for him for some bizarre fucking reason. They also then have to backdate all of the plays so that they happen before 1604. Which is, again, stupid, because the later plays allude to things that happened after 1604. So now you have, not only is this Edward de Vere, like, you know, a kind of mastermind of deception, he's also magic. You can see into the future. So you understand, like, once you start looking at it, it's just really stupid. Anyway. There we are. Why did Ruhlholm want another 2 minutes? Marty says, is writing books profitable? Which was the most profitable? Writing books generally is not profitable, I would say. I haven't had a check for Prophets of Doom yet, because it only came out in September, and it's December now, so I haven't had that. Populist Illusion was pretty profitable, I would say. I had good royalties from that book. It also sold most copies. Some of them are less than a couple of cups of coffee, but they're written for different reasons. The academic books are written to get promotions at work, basically, and the sales of them are to libraries and to universities to give to students on various courses. Whereas a book like Populist Illusion was written for a popular audience. So not that I've made any adjustment in how I write between those two things, because I always wrote my academic books so that they could be written, they could be read by a general reader. So I've made no adjustment to my style or anything. Although I would say that for books for popular audiences, Populist Illusion and Prophets of Doom are also quite, quote unquote, academic, if that makes any sense. Sensible Zoomer says, I wrote an essay for my undergrad about anti-fascism as Nietzschean slave morality, very inspired by the Truth Regime. We got an AC, so cheers, AA. Well, that's brilliant to hear, Sensible Zoomer. Very sensible it is too. Anti-fascism as Nietzschean slave morality. I would sounds like an interesting essay at the very least. Dr. Thrasher says, off topic, but I wanted to say I've been binging old and popular opinions, and it is fun listening back to election stuff again. Yes, I recently saw you blocked. Please undo. Well, what is your name on there, Dr. Thrasher? I'll never find you. You need to link to your Twitter profile or I'll never find you again. If it was a recent thing, you probably were dissing me. Don't diss me on Twitter. I'll immediately block you. Not thin skin. It's just always your loss. I've told people that before. You know, it's not a... It's like, have a go. If I see you in my comments having a go, you're out. End of. So I will unblock you on this occasion. But remember, just don't have a go. Don't be stupid. Ruleham says, stupid YouTube wouldn't let me send super chats for some reason. Here's extra reasons to read Foundations. Love your work and hope you smoke a great cigar with you one day to give my thanks. He's given me, ladies and gentlemen, $69.99 Canadian dollars, which is the super chat of the night. Well, thank you very much for that, Bruleham. I am definitely going to get Foundations. It sounds very interesting indeed. And that, I think, is that. So I'll be back tomorrow night with Unpopular Opinions. I just had a message from D saying that he's dealing with personal family matter at the moment and therefore will not be on Unpopular Opinions tomorrow night, which means that I need to find somebody to step in for D, sub for D for tomorrow. If he's not able to make it, I will have a look at who wants to come in. Maybe I'll ask Charlie or Stephen Radlib or somebody like that if they'll step in for the night. Yeah, British should come back, yeah. I did ask Ray to come back, but she doesn't want to. She's being all coy. She doesn't want to. He's basically he can't make it because he's going to be somewhere else. He's not going to be at his computer. Essentially. So, all right. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Death said, a super chatter called Death said, get Pete Quinones sub in. I could ask him. I mean, I don't think Pete Quinones has ever been on Unpopular Opinions. So I'll have to see who's around at this short notice. I'll ask around to see who wants to sub in for D for tomorrow. I mean, Jay Burden did pretty well last week. Maybe I'll ask him again. People seem to like the Jay Burden episode last week, so maybe I'll ask him. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. Remember, promo code VAXGLIDE2 gets you 25% off. I hope you enjoyed this. It wasn't too boring. I felt like I was being really boring, but maybe. Anyway, I'll see you tomorrow night.
The persecuted becomes the persecutor. The hunted becomes the hunter.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.